Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. We are pleased to be able to offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, and performers. For a list of our upcoming events, please pick up a copy of the November-December newsletter at the front desk. As we begin, may I remind you, please, to silence all electronic devices. I left mine downstairs, but if you didn't do that, please just turn it off or silence it. Thank you. I also remind you that the Society Library thrives and prospers through the generosity of its donors. Tax-deductible contributions can be made at any time throughout the year, including underwriting for events like this one. For more information, please speak to me or to our development staff or see our website. We have books for sale in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, and our speaker will be happy to sign copies following the event. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker. Thucydides, Herodotus, Xenophon, they are the most primary of primary sources, the historical references most trusted or challenged, and until the last few years, unless you could read classical languages, they experienced an itty-bitty lobe classical library volumes or somebody else's footnotes. But the landmark editions not only provide superlative new translations of these major works, but a beautiful reading experience. They are the kind of book that link us directly to the past. This is due in large part to the work of Robert B. Strassler. Mr. Strassler calls himself a scholar without credentials. He doesn't hold a named chair at a university. He's retired from business success, not academia. But his editions of the classics have broken sales records and unlocked antiquity's most intricate narratives for a modern audience. A graduate of Harvard, he also received an honorary doctorate from Bard College, and he serves as chairman of the Aston Magna Foundation for Music and the Humanities. Please join me in welcoming Robert B. Strassler.
Thank you, Sarah. Welcome to all of you. I'm delighted to be here. Beautiful room. I can imagine many wonderful things that took place here, and I'm very pleased to be one of the things I hope that will be in a long line of events here. I'm delighted that all of you came here to listen to me. You will find that I like to talk about my work, and so this is not an imposition of any kind. It's a pleasure. I intend to talk about the landmark books for the first half of my talk, all of them. Future as well as the ones that have been published. And then we'll concentrate a little bit on Xenophon and try to say a few words about him. He's kind of a slippery character in certain ways. It's hard to get a hold on him, but we'll do our best in the time we have. I came by editing the landmark books from a teaching experience somewhere at near the end of my business career in the 70s. I was invited to teach a course at Bard College at Simon's Rock in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I lived up there at the time. In fact, my son was a student there. And I was very good. I was on the board of overseers, and people thought I knew all about the histories, and I thought I did too. And so in my naivete, I accepted the responsibility of teaching and discovered that the fact that I'd read Herodotus and Thucydides three or four times in my 45 years or so did not qualify me at all to teach. And I had to do, it's the proverbial story, I had to work like mad to stay one lecture ahead of everybody in the class. And I ended up getting much more out of the experience than I'm sure that any of the students did. But that set me on the road to working in the field of education and with ancient Greek writers in translation. And I soon discovered, I then taught the course several times. I would wait about 3 years in between teaching assignments because I really don't understand how people teach every year the same material. I have to wait until I've forgotten what I said and lost my notes, and then I can go back and read Homer freshly. You know, the material is new and fresh, and I find new things in it. But over about 10 years, three or four classes, I was really impressed and amazed and very happy to see how these very intelligent young students took to things that I would have thought were very foreign to them, such as Homer and the Greek poets and the Greek players. Some of them are simple, but some of them are quite abstruse and difficult and very foreign from the experience of the 20th, 21st century young people. And then I was dismayed because they did seem to have trouble absorbing Thucydides and Herodotus, or Xenophon when we read him, because I considered them to be just standard, reasonable, modern style of histories. They're modern partly because they set the paradigm of how history is written, even today. And I would find over the last 2 months of the course that my students were slowly eyes glazing over, and you could see them dropping out one by one and losing contact with the material. And it was very distressing to me because I thought the material, I still do, of course, is the most marvelous histories, at least Thucydides and Herodotus. They're up there with the best that's ever been written. And I tried to figure out what was going on. Why did this happen? And I came to a conclusion after talking with them and talking with some other scholars in the field that the editions that we had available to teach from were very, very limited and difficult for them, made it difficult for them to absorb the wonderful history that was there. And partly it's that the material is so, the world of these ancient historians was so different from ours, we can't really blame them for not explaining so many things to us that were in that world, because they were writing for their own world and everybody knew about these things. And there's no reason why somebody in the 20th or 21st century is going to know about them. We just not have any training for them. Let me put up a, give you an idea of what, Mary, thank you. It's one of the things that are very different from the modern world. This is a little cylinder seal. They don't know whether, they call it Greco-Persian because they don't know who did it. It shows a Greek hoplite about to fight a Persian cavalryman. And that kind of combat, that kind of warfare, is simply not part of anything that we know today. That doesn't happen. They're about to be covered with each other's blood and sweat. And that kind of close combat, you see it in the movies maybe, but it's artificial in the movies. It's very difficult to understand. We really today don't know how a hoplite battle was conducted. How did people hack at each other and smash at each other? Did they push? Did they retreat? Did they have rotations? Did the front lines step back and fresh lines come forward? These are just, nobody told us, and we don't really know how it was done. That's a little bit difficult for them to understand. Can we get that back on? Here's another element of warfare that we can't expect people today to understand. These are warships that are powered by oars, by the crew. And the more people you can pack in there, the more powerful ship you've got. And so they ended up with a standard trireme with 175 rowers in it. There's no space in that ship for anybody to eat. There are just lots of elements of warfare with triremes that nobody today has ever thought about or worried about. How would you be prepared to understand what Thucydides says about triremes? And he says, for example, at one point, after the battle, they went back and picked up their tackle. And tackle turns out to be probably the best word for the translation of what he's talking about. But it's very puzzling. What are they doing? Well, there isn't a good explanation. Somebody figured it out. Before a battle, you would drop everything over the side or put it on a nearby beach that you didn't absolutely need to have on board so that the ship was as light and as maneuverable as possible. And then if you won or survived the battle, you went back and picked up that tackle. And if you won the battle, you'd go pick up the enemy's tackle. But these are not obvious things. These are things that somebody has to explain to you. Otherwise, it's curious. The other factor is you have to stop with these ships every day and let the crew get off and eat a good meal. You can't feed people in a ship this tightly packed. Aristophanes has jokes about people breaking wind in each other's faces because of the way the rowers were situated. And it's just impossible for me to understand how they did it at all in a hot summer day, rowing for 10, 12 hours. But apparently they did. It's one of the puzzling elements. Another one that's very puzzling, and this is these are from the illustrations from the Hellenica. Religion is simply a puzzle to everybody in the 21st century. There on the right, the boy is holding a liver that's taken from an animal that was living a few minutes ago. The seer behind him is explaining it to the warrior, saying, well, the omens are good, we can attack, or the omens are bad. If the liver was deformed or if it had speckles on it, that was bad news. The gods were seen as trying to communicate to you through a medium of the guts of animals that you sacrificed. Very odd. Try explaining that to a 12th grader or a junior in college who has never come across this kind of religious feeling. It's strange. And it's also a little barbaric. It's repulsive in a way. Here on the right, a warrior is shown sacrificing a sheep in order to get to the liver to find out what the gods want to tell him. Now, Xenophon was a very pious man, and there are many elements in the book in which he talks about the omens that were read in the sacrifices and that made them not do this or do this or wait. And he knew that if you didn't follow what these omens were, you were in danger of losing a battle and maybe your country losing a war, and certainly that you might lose your own life. So this was serious business. And it's very hard for 20th century people to take it seriously. Over there on the left, this is a sacrifice ceremony. The boy here is holding a bowl with blood from the animal just recently killed. The priest is sprinkling blood on the altar. The youth has the entrails of the animal on the pole, which is about to be roasted. That's actually a grill of some sort here. And then the other two are advising or watching or priests or the family that is conducting the ritual. And, you know, it's enough to say that this is very odd and very strange. And over here on the right, you have Nike, the goddess of victory, celebrating a victory, which all our armies did in those days. If you won the battle, you took a suit of armor from one of the fallen enemy, and you attached it to it. Oh, dear, what happened? Okay, so keep it awake. You attached it to a stump or a post that you erected. It was a trophy, and this was actually a gift back to the gods, a donation to the gods, in thanks for them having given you the victory. And again, these things are just odd and just difficult. Add to that some other elements of these histories. We find that there are no dates that anybody can use in the 20th century. What does it mean to somebody in the 20th century, 21st century, to be told that the battle was fought in the year that Archytas was the ephor at Sparta, or Achilleus was the eponymous ephon in Athens? Those are simply unusable datums for anybody to have. Or sometimes it's the agreement was reached in the year that the temple of Athena at Phocaea was hit by lightning and set on fire. Well, maybe that meant something in the 4th century. Maybe that helped people orient the year they knew about. But who can be expected to know anything about it today? And again, we can't really complain about this. The writers who wrote this wrote 2,500 years ago. How could they interpret or expect that the world would still be reading them 2,500 years from now, although Thucydides said it was for all time that he wrote? And how could they know how our life would change so much that they would have to explain these things to us? It's ridiculous. We would not, I think, dare to predict what life will be like, human life, in, let's say, 200 years. I doubt that anybody really has an idea of what it's going to look like in 2200. So that's just the situation. And people are very they read this and they can't figure out what this means, what events take place, the significance, the religious significance, the social significance, the political significance. There were umpty-ump political systems that each state, political state, had. There were 700 political states in ancient Greece. And while some of them were powerful and important and we know about them, there were lots and lots of others that did have a role to play, and people lived in, and things happened there. And it's just, what happens is you read it, the student reads it, or the modern reader reads it, and he has to go on leaving things behind because he doesn't understand. He doesn't know where this took place. He doesn't know the year in which it took place. He doesn't know its relationship to 10 pages from now when he's reading about another event in another place. And so the lack of context, the lack of connection with it, every time you pass by something you don't know in a text, it creates a little barrier between you and that text. And these barriers are cumulative. Finally, by page 30, for some people page 50, some people make it all the way to page 100. But at some point, you're floating free. You don't know what's going on. And you give up in terms of your contact with the material. It loses a key element. It becomes a sort of literary exercise. The key element is its historicity. The fact is that they are writing about real people who were dealing with real problems and real events, making decisions in the pressure of the imperatives of the present, like we do now in our present. They were acting, of course, in their present. It's our past, but their present. And you lose that. You've lost the essence of what these guys were writing. And, of course, they weren't writing fables, and they weren't writing literature, although some of it is very good literature. And so it becomes a bore. It becomes something that lacks essential meaning. And this is really a shame, because these are really good writers in all respects, very good historical writers. So that's the problem I faced, that I recognized, and has been recognized by other teachers and professors for years, for all the time. And it was what I tried to set myself to do something about. And I looked around for accommodating editions that had been written before with the idea of somehow making it more explicable, more understandable. And I was astonished to find that it hadn't been done. And I think I now know the reason why it hasn't been done. I think I'll just be brief about it. It takes a lot of work, and the computer is essential to being able to do it effectively. For example, as you will see, I have a lot of maps. Thucydides has 146 maps, one for each episode. And the same rule is followed for Herodotus and Xenophon, Hellenica. And the way you do the maps is you set up the territory you think you'll cover. You put in the places that you think are in the text that you want to explain and support. And then you iterate it. You make it the scale bigger. You break it up into two and have a large scale and a small scale part. You add some places from the future. You take some places out and put them in an earlier map. You play with it, and you come to an optimum solution. And you can do that with a computer effectively and keep records of everything you've done quite easily. To do that by hand would be so tedious. 147 maps, you'd go crazy. You wouldn't be able to do it. So that's one element where the computer was extraordinarily, I think, liberating to make it possible. The second thing was I deal with a lot of appendix writers, scholars that write appendices on subjects that I really believe the modern reader needs to have some more backup material on. So if you're dealing with 14 or 15 or 20 or 22 appendix writers, and you're editing it with snail mail and telephone, we'd still be working on Thucydides. But email made it possible for everybody to travel. I could go to Europe and plug in. I'm still in contact. They could go on their vacations. We could be in contact intimately and at the level we needed to, passing back text, making suggestions, criticizing, et cetera. These were things that were possible with email. So that's a second element in which the computer was vital. And the third one was the computer gave me the idea of trying to find an accommodating, easy-to-use text. There was an art developed for computers of making instructions for how to install and operate fairly arcane and difficult software, and it became writing user-friendly instructions. And that gave me the idea of why not have a user-friendly, it's an inelegant phrase, but it's accurate, and it's hasn't been done. So we can call it reader-friendly, sounds a little better. But in effect, that gave me the idea of seeing what could be done with the text of Thucydides or Herodotus to make it easier for people to get involved and stay connected to the material throughout. And the result is the landmark books. Let's see what we have next here. It's not working. Can you click to the next one? Okay. I just, what I want to show you, the basic thing that we did first with the landmark books was maps. I mentioned how many maps we have, one for each episode. But I want to point out that maps can be bad as well as good. This is a map in the modern library edition of Thucydides. It's on two pages of a book this size. All right, it has 165 sites labeled on those two pages. And they're so densely packed that if you know where Athens is, you can find it. But normally, if you consult for some place you don't know where it is, and if you want to find, let's say, Chalkidiki, which is a pretty big place, or Knossos, or some place in Leontini in Sicily, and you don't know it's in Sicily, well, you can search for 20 minutes on that map and not find it. And what happens is after your first or second unsuccessful attempt to find something there, you give up and you don't bother using it. It's not a help. It's, in effect, it makes you feel bad because you failed. It's there, but you can't find things on it. So it's actually intimidating and worse than nothing. Let's see if I can get it to, okay. Here's another one. This is in the Penguin edition of Thucydides. I don't know where they got this map, but they just took it out of the drawer and threw it in the book. It maybe, perhaps, was a naval chart, and it may once have been tinted. But at this point, you're looking at it the way it is in the book, and it's very hard to figure out which of those lines is sea level and which ones are going up and which ones are going down. It tells you that the contours in underwater are 60 feet, so it's 10 fathoms, which we don't use fathoms anymore, particularly for historical maps. It's got some labels on it here, the Osman Aga Lagoon. It's not mentioned in Thucydides, and we now think it wasn't there in Thucydides' time because we found some Hellenistic ruins in that place. What did I do again? All right. We'll just have to play with this. The harbor presupposes that this is the harbor, but it's not necessarily the harbor. It would be the harbor for a 18th or 19th century fleet, not necessarily the only harbor here for a fleet of triremes. The Sicia Channel is not mentioned by Thucydides. All of these, Voida Coelia, Neocastro, these are modern Greek names. So if you're a reader of Thucydides and you want to get help from this map, you might as well, you're better off not looking at it. It's just going to confuse the hell out of you. And it does have a couple of places that are mentioned in Thucydides, but they're spelled differently. So it really... And I want to testify that in 147 maps, spelling everything the same way is not trivial. It is hard, but we did it, I hope. Maps can be really destructive then. Let's see if we can get to the next one here. Space bar, I think, or... Okay. Well, now we zipped ahead about five. That's probably responding to me. Okay. Okay, finally. Okay. This is a landmark map from Xenophon. You can see that it's very clean and neatly laid out. Pantheon has allowed us to have two color maps, which means the blue is always water, and it helps the eye instantly assimilate which is the water. And in time, you become familiar with the landforms, and it's easier and easier to interpret these maps at a glance. You'll see that there's a little inset there, a border, and that obviously represents this map. What that permits us to do is have a different scale. If we took all the labels on this map and we put them in this space, there would be so much written material that it would obscure the coastlines, and some of these dots would be so close together that they wouldn't really provide you with any reasonable relationship information for geography. So we solve that by getting a different scale and yet showing where it is in the major, larger context. Here's another map that's done twice. Up there shows the major area from Carthage all the way to Turkey. We have to have that because Xenophon mentions Carthage there. We want to show the reader where that is. And so we have an outline here, which is now the Aegean Basin. And in the Aegean Basin, the action really taking place here in the Marmara Sea. And so we have a second, if you will, insert map. And this is where the real stuff is taking place. And again, if you took all these labels and put them in here, it would be just a mess. So that's kind of the, I want to say that these are not my maps. I drew the blueprint of what should be on the map, and then I turned them over to a wonderful professional group of cartographers up in Watertown, Massachusetts, nearby me, and they make these quite extraordinarily nice maps. And there are no labels here that aren't in the text, and they are all spelled the same way. So we try to reduce confusion in every way, and we make it as easy as possible. You don't have to go to the back of the book to check the map. You know when there's a place mentioned that you're within two pages forward or back of finding where it is. And in fact, there's a footnote that tells you at the bottom of the page which map you're going to go to find it. And if there's a lot of labels on the map, there's a place where on Asia Minor, a lot's taking place, there's many labels. We even provide a rudimentary set of coordinates, AX, AY, which is in the footnote, so you know which corner of the map to look for to find it, because there's like 40 labels on it. And that we don't want to make you take time. We want to make it easy for you. So the maps are a critical element. You notice that the pages have a lot of white space and that each page is different. This is what I just happened to grab a Penguin edition of Herodotus. This is what the pages look like. And a lot of people will have told me that that's formidable. One page after the other of black text is off-putting. It's intimidating. I could never read that, I have people say to me. Well, of course they can. It's plain, easy English to read. Understanding what's going on requires some help, but there's no reason why it can't be read. But this is done with intention by a very intelligent woman named Kim Llewellyn, who's the page designer for all of the Landmark books. And she juggles the maps and the appropriate location where it has to go, because it has to support the surrounding episode. And she also works to make sure that the side notes are in the right place. There's a lot of information on this page. Up at the top, there's a running header that tells you what book you're in, where it's taking place, and the year, if we know the year. We often don't. That's a general side point. Too many books for general readers or for students try to adopt a sort of omniscient tone, as if we know everything, and they come away with the impression that the professor or the school or the field really is all buttoned up and everybody knows everything. And that's quite untrue in ancient history. I would say about one-third of these things are really known with any certainty. Others are guesses, and scholars fight and scream and yell and argue over a tremendous amount. So when we don't know something, this book says we don't know it. And if we don't know where it is, we have a question mark after it when it's listed. Or we say the location is unknown. I don't try to solve the problems, but I let the reader know that scholars do not agree on the interpretation of this sentence or that point. The white space, a very eminent scholar complained that the white space is wasted paper and the book comes out too heavy. Well, I agree with him, the book's too heavy, but the white space isn't wasted. It helps make the page look inviting and interesting, and we're, after all, in the business of trying to seduce or persuade people to come in and read this book, and we think that that's not a trivial element in getting them to do that. Now, there are other things that help. There are footnotes explain what's going on, and if you can't explain it in a footnote, the footnote will refer you to an appendix. For example, we talked about all the religious problems. There's an appendix on religion in ancient Greece in Xenophon's time, and we'll tell you to go to that appendix, and we'll tell you to go to a paragraph in that appendix, and we try very hard to make the appendices short, because if somebody goes, takes the trouble to go there and he looks at it, one of the things they always do is they check how long the appendix is, and if it's more than 3 pages, they're not going to read it. But if it's less than 3 pages and it's interesting, they might be induced to read the whole appendix. And we're trying to get them to make use of that background information. So this method in our madness is what I'm saying. And a tremendous amount of effort has gone in here to provide the reader with the information they need to understand as much as we can help them do to understand what is going on in the text. So we have the appendices. We have a very thorough index. I mean, it's like a 280, 300-page text. We have an 80-page index. I had one indexer tell me once that, well, you don't make it too easy on them. And I answered, yes, of course. I want to make it as easy as possible. The index is to help people find where they were, to find something in the text. And so we have a lot of redundancy in the text. In addition to that, we have illustrations. You've seen the illustrations of the religious vases. Those are beautiful art, and they did tend to show, they show the reader that these religious things that Xenophon is talking about were real in the culture, real enough to get into its art. But most of the illustrations that we select are not art, and they're not beautiful. I have to come back to that. They are there to show the reader again, to emphasize the historicity. This is from Herodotus. At one point he mentions walking in the street of a city and looking down on a big temple on its roof, as if it were in a pit. And that sounds kind of strange. Why is that? How did that happen? Well, of course, what happens is the Nile floods every year, and it gets higher, and then in urban renewal in a mud brick city, they just topple it down, and they build a new one on top, and it rises over the years. In this temple, we know where it was. The one he was talking about has long been destroyed, but it was built in about 2500 BC. So it was about 2,000 years old when he was there. And the relationship between him and that temple is the same as between us and this temple. This is a Ptolemaic temple, about 2,000 years old, in the city of Esna in the middle Nile, and you can walk on that street level up there, and you're looking down on the roof of this rather astoundingly big and well-preserved temple. That's about 60, looking at the guy in there, it's about 60 feet high. We put the picture there not because it's the same place Herodotus was talking about, but it's the same phenomena. It's a parallel, and so that the reader can't say, well, he must be pulling my leg, or that's ridiculous. Here's another one which is just like it. So, that's why, it's not a pretty picture, but that's why we selected it. Here's another one we selected. This is for Thucydides. We looked at the map of Pylos. There was a battle at Pylos that Thucydides describes in some detail, and 400 Spartans were taken prisoner by the Athenians. It was the first great victory for the Athenians in the war. And the shields and equipment from the Spartans was hung up in the temples of Athens as trophies. And a later writer, first century, 500 years later, Pausanias, wrote that he saw the Spartan equipment nailed up in the Athenian temples. Of course, the temples are all gone, and the equipment's all gone. But this was found, this shield was found at the bottom of a well in the 1930s when they were digging up the Agora. And you can go find it in the Agora Museum. If you hold it up to the light, you see that there have been holes punched in it to spell out a certain set of words. And it says, the Athenians took me from the Lacedaemonians out of Pylos. So here's an object that was there where Thucydides is talking about. It's not a fairy tale. This thing was there. It's one of those shields. And it was in that battle. And you can go to the Agri Museum and see it. And if the guard isn't looking, you can touch it. It's real. Right? And that's why the picture is there. Here's a from Xenophon example. Xenophon talks about how the walls of Themistocles were torn down by the victorious Spartans in 404. And 10 years later, 11 years later, a Persian fleet. Now, you've got to imagine, this is about 100 years or 90 years after Salamis, the great victory over the Persian fleet. A Persian fleet comes into Athens and helps the Athenians rebuild their walls. And it's under the direction of an Athenian general named Conon. And those are Conan's brickworks on top to repair the walls of Themistocles. The two walls are about 190 years apart. But there is, again, an example of exactly something that Xenophon is talking about. And it's real. It's again, driving home that this is not a fairy tale. One last example. Oh, that's a map just to show you. There's the walls of Piraeus down at the bottom. And this next slide will show you something of the Keramikos burial ground. That's, you can still go there and see many of the eminent people's tombstones. This is a very interesting group. Thucydides says, not Thucydides, Xenophon says, that there was a skirmish between the Athenians and the Spartans right near Athens, right just outside of Athens in Piraeus. And some Spartans were killed, and for some reason they were made heroes, and the Athenians took up the bodies and buried them in the Spartan manner. That is, the Athenians would have been burned and the bones buried, but the Spartans apparently didn't do that. The bodies were laid out, and a tomb was built for them in the Keramikos, which was for only heroic and outstanding Athenians. That's the tomb, and these are the bodies that were found in 1933 or 34 when it was dug up. And you can't see the top row because it's been taken off of stones, because it was taken off to the Epigraphical Museum, but there's an epigraphy there that has the word Lacedaemonian in it, and it mentions also two names of people who were among the dead, who Xenophon mentioned by name. So there's an obvious case. These are the guys he's talking about. They're skeletons, presumably. And this is the tomb. He says they were buried in the Keramikos, and there it is. So those are the kind of things that we think help create verisimilitude in a sense of keep your nose to the grindstone that this is real. These people actually died here. These people fought. They made their decisions. They made their mistakes. They suffered, and they had to worry about the future the same way that we are worrying about the future. That's a portrait of Xenophon. You don't have to believe it. I don't believe it, but it has a certain as you will see, I hope, a certain relation to the kind of writer he was at the end. Put it, disgruntled, weary, unhappy. He had an interesting life, and we have about 13 or 14 works that he wrote. We probably have as much of his writings as we have of any ancient writer. When he was a young man, he grew up in a wealthy family, apparently, and was a member of the Athenian cavalry. You had to be wealthy to take care of a horse. And he wrote later about the art of taking care of horses and the art of being a cavalry general, what things you have to look for and take care of and make sure that your troops do. And as a cavalryman, he was sort of, I guess, an aristocratic fellow, and he may not have liked the democracy. In any case, when the Spartans defeated the Athenians in 404 and blockaded the city and forced its surrender, Xenophon doesn't say this, but we know from other sources that the Spartans insisted on having a small group of Spartan of Athenians take over and run the country. The democracy was dissolved, and that may have been something that in the beginning Xenophon welcomed, although he, as you read what he says about the tyranny of the 30 that took over, it becomes clear that he regretted it. And when the democracy was restored a year later, which it was, I think he felt it might have been wise to get out of town. The 30 were really bad guys. They did a lot of criminal things, and they, as people in that position will do, they try to implicate as many people as possible in their crimes. They had the cavalry do certain things, like round up people and send them for execution, people who were quite innocent but who had property that the state needed. I'm speculating a little bit about it because he doesn't say this, but he did leave town, even though he asked Socrates himself whether he should go, and Socrates said, don't go, but he didn't obey Socrates at this point. He also asked the oracle at Delphi, and she gave him a slippery answer and allowed him to go. And he went off to the Middle East. He went off to join the mercenary forces of a pretender to the Persian throne, a man called the younger Cyrus, to differentiate him from the great Cyrus in the beginning. And he marched with them all the way down to Mesopotamia. And outside of Babylon, they fought a battle at a place called Kunaxa, which we not absolutely positive where it was precisely. And the Greeks won their part of the battle, but Cyrus and his Persians lost their part of the battle, and Cyrus was killed. And the Greeks were found themselves, 10,000 of them more or less, in the middle of a hostile country with the hostile victors of the battle around them. And the first thing the Persians did was call a conference with the leaders of the Greeks and then proceed to assassinate them. So the Greeks had to elect new leaders, and apparently Xenophon says he was elected as one of the leaders. And they fought their way north, straight north, to the Black Sea, through some of the worst country you can imagine, and in winter. It must have been, well, we know it was pretty awful because he wrote a book about it called The Anabasis, The March Up Country. And I would say 100 years ago, 150 years ago, every schoolboy knew the Anabasis as much as today everybody knows Huck Finn. I mean, it was a classic adventure story and part of the first-year Greek or second-year Greek matriculation. That was one of his earlier works. And perhaps he blew up his own role in it to the point where he thought it wise to have it published under the name of a pseudonym, Themistogenes of Sicily, which is somebody nobody. He doesn't appear anywhere else in history, and we know it's by Xenophon. Stylistically and in other ways, it's clear. So he marched with the army north to the Black Sea. They got on a bunch of boats and went back to the Dardanelles. There, the Spartans were about to enter a war with the Persians. The Spartans had defeated the Athenians with the help of the Persians and then found themselves taking over the Athenian Empire and now defending the Asiatic Greeks, that is, the Greeks who lived in Turkey. And as Alcibiades had predicted, they had to go to war to protect the Greeks. And they hired the mercenaries from Cyrus, including Xenophon, to fight with them. So Xenophon started what was 10 or 15 years of fighting with the Spartan army. He was a commander of the cavalry, and he was apparently became a confidant of the Spartan king Agesilaus, who conducted all these campaigns with some success. And he writes about them quite well in Hellenica. And then at some point, the Persian response was to start throw some money into Greece and induce a bunch of Greek states to go to war with Sparta. So that took Sparta's mind off the war with Persia, and they called Agesilaus back. The Persians got to be very good at beating the Greeks with money, not with blood. And they kept the Greeks, whom they must have considered very troublesome and difficult, the barbarians on their border, kept them embroiled with each other for years and years. And if anybody got to a point of strength, the Persians helped organize a coalition of other states. And again, the hegemon was defeated. And so if you get the impression from Herodotus that the Persians weren't clever, don't believe it. They were very clever. And the Spartans, Agesilaus, had to go back to Greece, and in one of the battles, they fought against Athenians, and that means that Xenophon fought against Athenians, for which he was exiled. And since he never complained about his exile, the implication is that he felt it was justified, that he had done something that called for, and I guess he accepted it, and he lived in the Peloponnese. The Spartans gave him an estate on land they took from a Peloponnesian state called Elis. It was up near Olympus, and he lived there for 20 years as sort of a country gentleman, married, had children, and sat down to write, and he started to write all of these books that we know about. We think that that was about the time he started writing the first part of Hellenica, which is the end of the Peloponnesian War, the 7 years from 411 to 404, 403, and that he then later, many years later, perhaps 20 years later, in the 360s, he may have sat down to write the rest of the history. He's an interesting and a good writer. He avoids simplicity. I can give you a couple of examples that bring it on. There was a man named Anaxibios, and Anaxibios was a Spartan who had crossed swords with Xenophon apparently early on. They'd had a quarrel somewhere in the 400s, and in 389, Anaxibios was killed in an ambush. And it's shown that not only was he nasty to Xenophon, but he used undue influence in order to gain his position as leader of the Spartans in the Hellespont, the Dardanelles, and that he then went out on a mission without paying attention to the omens, which was a no-no by Xenophon's standard. The omens had predicted disaster, and he said, so what, then don't pay any attention, and they marched out. And a very intelligent and very effective Athenian general named Iphicrates set a trap for him, and he failed to reconnoiter and send out scouts, and so he walked right into the trap. And at this point, you've got an impression that he's a real bad guy. And yet, when the trap is sprung, Xenophon gives him his due. He acts as a brave Spartan should. He tells his friends to leave and flee and save themselves. And we're having fun here with the... Head up till you get to the first portrait. Two more. There you go. And he stays and fights, and his men will not leave him. They stay with him, and they are all killed. So that at least it points out that if you want to sum up his character, it's a complex summation that you're involved with, not just a bad guy, but a bad guy with good points, at least, and enough to win. There's another one, a man named Talutius, who was a Spartan general, who was presented as a paragon of military virtue, somebody who paid attention to his troops' comforts, who shared their privations, who was always accessible to them, who cared about morale, and always was applauded by his troops and supported by his troops. And yet, at one moment, the crisis of his life, he gets angry at the audacity of the enemy's cavalry, and he orders a charge in his rage, and the charge goes too far. They drive off the cavalry, but they end up too close to the city walls of Olynthus where they're battling. And as they approach the walls, they begin to be hit by missiles from the walls, and the troops recoil. And at that moment, the Olynthians come running out, the infantry charges, and the recoil turns into a rout. And Talutius is killed, as well as many of his soldiers. And Xenophon draws the moral, you never lose your temper if you're a general. You don't act that way. So he's a great fellow and a terrific general, but he had a major fault. And again, you have a rounded picture and something that you don't always find in ancient history. Well, one other thing we need to cover, I'd like to cover, is that Xenophon was a student of Socrates. And he wrote about Socrates. Socrates plays a very minor role in the Hellenica, minor but critical. At a certain point in time, he's the epistates. He's in charge of the proceedings of the Athenian council. And at the time that the mob is howling for the blood of some unsuccessful generals, he refuses to carry or to open a motion that would permit them to have their way. And they say to him, intolerable that in a democracy that the people, the demos, can't have its own way. And he says he just says it has to be done by law. He will do nothing that is not by law. And he apparently holds them off. But that's his only role in the Hellenica. But Xenophon wrote four other works about Socrates. And it's fair to say that Socrates is the first person in the ancient world of which we have two explorations of character and expositions of character, one by Plato and one by Xenophon. And they're not the same. Well, Plato's changes over time. At the very end, in Plato's last works, Socrates is just a mouthpiece for logical exposition. But Plato says, even in his earlier works, that everybody loved Socrates. His students loved him. He was very likable and very fine fellow. And yet the one he writes about is not really a likable fellow. He's somebody who delights in trapping people linguistically into, you know, this is equal to that, and if that's the opposite of this, then that means that your original position is obviously... And trapping people into, well, I guess you're right, Socrates, type of thing. But it's not likable at all. It's manipulative and it's bullying, and may have logic on its side, although it's a logic that it's very easy to find fault with. He's not a very nice person, as Plato writes about him. Xenophon, he is a very nice person, and he doesn't do that. He doesn't play games. I will tell you about one vignette. There are many vignettes that Xenophon writes to show this. There was a young man under 20 years old named Glaucon who was announcing to everybody that he had now an ambition to become the chief minister of state, the chief statesman for Athens. And he was talking about it so frequently that he was making an ass of himself and subject to ridicule. And Socrates, as this is Xenophon writing, Socrates goes up to him and says, I understand you want to become the first minister of state. He says, yes, Socrates, that's what I'm going to do now. So Socrates, well, that's wonderful. It's a laudable ambition. You certainly want to benefit the country. And the kid says, yes, of course. He says, well, don't keep it a secret. Tell us, how are you going to increase the revenues of Athens? And what are the revenues today? Well, he said, I haven't really thought about that, Socrates. Oh, well, okay, maybe what you want to do is reduce our expenditures. Perhaps there are some, you've discovered some way that we can safely cut some of our, well, no, Socrates, actually, I hadn't given that any attention. Well, perhaps, let's talk about defense. Perhaps you have a way that we can increase Athenians' power relative to its potential enemies. Well, I haven't really. And he goes on, and this goes on for five or six. And finally, the kid says, are you making fun of me? And he said, well, no, I really think that there's a place to start. There's 10,000 households in Athens. Why don't you start to improve one of them, like your uncle's? Your uncle's house, his farm is pretty bad shape. And he says, oh, yes, I could improve that if I could get my uncle to listen to me and follow my advice. And so he says, well, if you can't get your uncle to follow your advice, how are you going to get 20,000 Athenians to follow your advice? And it's a very nice progression, kind and gentle, to bring him to the point of realization that it's a bizarre and insane ambition at this point, and he should forget about it. So there's more to read. You've got plenty if you want to do it. It is fun, and I haven't read a good book about it, but there may be somebody should write a good book about it. It is, as I say, he is the first person, but we have two diametrically opposed or different. There's places where they match, too, but two different views. I want to close with a couple of quotes, and these actually lie at the end of his book. He was a Spartanophile, that is, he liked Sparta. He owed Sparta everything, and he had fought for Sparta for many years. And that didn't mean he didn't criticize Sparta. He was very critical of Spartans' failings as we talked about these generals who one flew into a rage and lost his battle, another one didn't carry out the right things but turned out at least to die bravely. There are a couple of events that Sparta carried out which he roundly condemned. And he thought it was proper for the Thebans to finally defeat the Spartans because the Spartans had treacherously captured the Acropolis of Thebes during a time of peace and held it for 20 years or 10 years. And he thought this was just horrible. And the men who did it were indicted but not convicted. And there were a number of things that Sparta did that he truly disapproved of. And he wrote the Spartan Constitution in which he said the Spartans now are not living up to those ideals that they once had. He wrote about the ideals that they... And then he said, well, they're really not up to it now. They don't seem to be doing it anymore. So they were a disappointment to him. Again, that's the expression on his face there a little bit. And what happened, of course, is in 371, Sparta's hegemony began in 404. That is, after it defeated Athens. And for 10 years, it was a worldwide, that is, an Aegean-wide hegemony. And then this Persian fleet under Conon defeated the Spartan fleet, and it became just a hegemony in the Peloponnesus. And in 371, the Thebans came down. Let me see if I have a map that I can, yeah. The Thebans came down from Thebes and attacked the field army of Sparta at Leuctra. And for the first time in 200 years, the Spartan army in the field was defeated, badly defeated, heavy casualties. And it was because of new tactics developed by a military genius named Epaminondas of Thebes. And the next year, Epaminondas marched into Peloponnesus, down to Sparta. He didn't take the city, didn't try. The Spartans had no walls, but they were defending in between the buildings, and they had men and women on top of the buildings. And the Thebans just plundered the area. Xenophon writes how the women of Sparta were upset to see the fires of the farms and smoke from the villages coming up, which they had inflicted so often on other parts of Greece, but had not happened to them in 200 years. And one of the bases of Spartan power was its control of Messenia. Having both of these areas made Sparta one of the largest states in the Peloponnese. And Epaminondas, after spoiling this area, goes over to Mount Itome, the traditional capital of Messenia. This is in 370. And he liberates the Messenians from Spartan rule. And he builds these walls at Mount Itome. And you can look, these walls are built hell for stout. Those blocks are made in such a way that they don't all line up. They're resistant to, that means resistant to earthquakes. And these things go uphill and down across valleys. It's a circuit of 5.5 miles. And it must have been very expensive to do. And it must have taken a while. And they must have been able to do it without Spartan interference. These are today still some of the finest finest examples of 4th century defenses that you can find in Greece. In some places, the walls are 29 feet high. And if you look at this, this one block weighs about 40 tons. It's 17 feet long and 3 feet wide and 4 feet high. I mean, they did that for show. I mean, they didn't have to do that at the gate. That was a lintel. They did it to tell the Spartans, you're never going to be able to take this place back. And by doing this, and it's true, they never did. Sparta tried, but they never succeeded. And these pictures are in the book, not to validate anything that Xenophon says, but to point out to the reader that Xenophon managed to avoid mentioning one of the key geopolitical events of his time. By freeing Messenia, Sparta ceased to be a player on a world scene and became just a little local wrangler in a corner of the Peloponnese for all times, forever after that. And so if you want to say his book begins with Spartan hegemony at the end of the 5th century, and by 360, Spartan power is really over for good. And this is the event that did it. These are the remains that make it clear we don't need him to tell us But what we have to marvel at is how could he avoid mentioning this? It must have been unpleasant if you're a Spartanophile to admit that Sparta will never... He does backhandedly mention it. He mentions, for example, oh, the Spartans wouldn't agree to this treaty because it recognized the independence of Messenia. Well, okay, that's a way of acknowledging, but all of Greece knew about this, and they must have said, how could old Xenophon avoid mentioning this? I mean, it must have puzzled. And the answer, of course, is that it's proof that Karl Rove didn't invent spin. He was just not able and willing to talk about loathsome events that he couldn't bear to bring himself to, that they're permanent. And he wrote about how the Spartans kept hoping that they would end, go back to where they were. And, of course, he died before they gave up trying to do that. So I bring that to the reader's attention and to your attention, that Xenophon can be slippery. I don't think he makes up things. I don't think he lies. But he surely will avoid talking about things that disturb him. Let me read a couple of quotes that he brings. He brings his work to the end. The first one is about a cavalry action that takes place at Mantinea, which is up here, in 362, a preliminary to the great last battle of if you want, independent powers in Greece. And the Athenian horsemen apparently do well against the Thebans and the Thessalians, who were considered by far to be the best horsemen in Greece. And it's also true that in this action, Xenophon's son, Gryllos, died and was killed, fighting for the Athenians. And he writes, "Brave were the men among those who died, and it is clear that the men they killed were equally brave, for no one had a weapon so short that he did not reach his enemy with it, and the Athenians did not abandon the corpses of their own men, but rather gave back some of the enemy dead under truce." And so he manages to express his pride in the success of his old units, the Athenian cavalry, and also a certain pride in the valor of his son, without ever mentioning... Well, everybody knew Gryllos was a hero in the Athenian lexicon of heroes. Everybody knew what had happened, but he, with great reticence, doesn't mention anything more than that. And in that way, he conveys quite cleverly a sense of loss and grief about it, even though he's lauding the victory. And then a few pages later, he writes about the unexpected outcome of the great battle of Mantinea in 362. This was the same year that his son, same battle, effectively, a few days later, between the Thebans and their allies under Epaminondas and the Spartans and their allies. Again, Epaminondas' tactics win out, and the Spartan field army is defeated. But Epaminondas is killed in the battle. In those days, generals fought right up in the front lines. And once he was killed, all steam went out of the Boeotians. They did not pursue. They did not try to exploit the victory. Everything stopped. And Xenophon writes, "When the battle was over, the result was the opposite of what everyone had expected. Given that nearly all of Greece was gathered there and had stood with one side or the other, everyone thought that if a battle occurred, the victor would rule over the defeated and the defeated would be subject to the victor. But the gods so arranged it that each side set up a trophy and gave back the dead under the truce as if victorious, and both received back their dead under the truce as if defeated. And although each side claimed the victory, neither side was seen to have gained anything, no city, territory, or increased rule that they did not have prior to the battle. In Greece as a whole, there was more uncertainty and disturbance after the battle than there had been before." So the decisive outcome that everybody looked to didn't happen, and life went on with the same problems. He then ends with the lines, "To this point, then, let it be written by me. Perhaps someone else will be concerned with what happens after this." And that's the end. And I think that I'll end my talk there, too. So thank you. I guess it's customary. Yes.
Are you happy to have questions?
I'm happy to have questions, yeah.